This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Tom Aswell, one of the top bloggers on Louisiana politics and our world at large. Tom Aswell will discuss Governor Jindal, transparency in government, and the travels of our chief executive. Also, Herbie Polanto is the biographer of Elizabeth Montgomery, the bewitched life and career of Elizabeth Montgomery. Twitch Upon a Star is Herbie's book. Elizabeth Montgomery, of course, played Samantha on Bewitched from 1964 to 1972. And Lauren Lee Stewart, executive director and program coordinator of the Greater Baton Rouge Clean Cities Coalition. We'll talk about a major happening, the Greater Baton Rouge Clean City Coalition's Louisiana Odyssey Day event. All this today, but first the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our numbers are 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. You may reach us online at inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with Tom Aswell, native of Ruston. He's lived in Baton Rouge for three decades. 10 of those years ran the Capital News Service, covering state government for 40 weekly, small, and daily newspapers around the state. He's also the author of the comprehensive history of Louisiana rock and roll, Louisiana Rocks, the true genesis of rock and roll. But he's here today primarily to talk politics. And good morning to you, Tom Aswell.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Understand you've made some public records requests.
Yes, I have.
How's that going?
Well, I think it's headed to court. In June, Representative Joe Harrison sent out a letter of solicitation on state letterhead requesting $1,000 donations to help send 30 Louisiana legislators to the annual conference of the American Legislative Exchange Council, better known as ALEC. And because this letter was sent out on state letterhead, I deem that it is public record, and I made a request for his mailing list, which has been denied by House Clerk Bruce Butch Spear.
So, can you resolve this short of going to court, Tom?
No, it's already at loggerheads. I think we're headed to court. I think the suit's going to be filed within a week.
Why would that kind of information be withheld? It really doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
He said that, first of all, Mr. Spear said only one copy of the letter went out, which I find very difficult to believe because the letter was trying to send 30 legislators to a national conference in Utah, and he was asking $1,000 donations. I don't think $1,000 would quite cover the tab for 30 legislators, not the way they like to party and eat and drink. So I'm assuming that letter went out to more people than
You're
just one.
You're assuming that?
I'm assuming.
You don't know, though?
I don't know.
Don't know. And, of course, we would certainly take delight in having Representative Harrison or Butch Spear as guests on this show. Now, Butch is working for the House.
Yes, he's
just doing what his
He's taking his marching orders.
Yeah. Yeah, like most people do.
Yeah, from Cleckley. Chuck Cleckley, the Speaker of the House. So I have no animosity toward Butch. He's helped me in the past on some records and been very cooperative. In fact, he promised to get this to me, to give me this information. He promised it to me. I have an email saying that. But he changed direction because he was told to.
Well, 297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation. The outspoken, provocative blogger Tom Aswell, who has gained a reputation as part of the anti-Jindal crowd. Is that fair?
No.
Why?
I don't think so. I'm not anti-Jindal. I just don't agree with a lot of his platform, his programs. I think I told you one time before on this show, I voted for Jindal twice, in 03 and 07. I thought he was going to be a good governor, and I'm disappointed in him, but I'm not anti-anyone.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have any other public records requests that are floating out there?
Well, I made one for that letter that the Advocate publicized Sunday, which featured my name rather prominently. And Shelby McKenzie sent me an email yesterday saying it was part of the attorney-client privilege, which I understand that.
Shelby McKenzie is the attorney for LSU.
That's correct.
So what are you seeking from Louisiana State University?
I wanted a copy of that letter that he sent, where he advised not to release the records on deliberative process. On
he being Shelby?
Yes. And the reason I wanted that record is because Elizabeth Murrell, the executive counsel, the former executive counsel for the governor, she's now at the Division of Administration, demanded that she review all records that were being released to me. And that was the crux of that letter. And I wanted to copy that letter. Somehow the advocate got it. I didn't.
Okay. 877-217-5757, wherever you are, for Tom Aswell, who takes no prisoners. Bruce and Walden. Hi, Bruce. You're on with Tom.
Yeah, hey, you guys. Tom, I really like Louisiana voice. It's kind of really classic and good muckraking. I just wanted to, I guess, make a suggestion or ask a question. I mean, what you're up against is far more than what any one muckraker could do. And I mean, there are some natural allies for you, like Katrina Jackson, who's really fighting the same fight around privatization and, secrecy and, this virtual dictatorship we're looking at here. And I was wondering if you thought about becoming more of a voice for a movement to change some of this stuff.
Well, as a journalist, and I still consider myself a journalist, I spent 25 years as a newspaper reporter and still report for about 30 newspapers. I don't like to get into causes that much. I am in the process of kicking off an online newspaper to cover Louisiana government, the more mundane stories, not the muckraking stories so much, but just the routine stories. And that's LouisianaFreePress.com.
297-5633 for Tom Aswell, the Rustonian who's down here in Baton Rouge. Did you like it when Bruce called you a muckraker?
No. That's an honorable term.
You do like it?
Yes.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
Now, Governor Jindal has been a traveling man, like Ricky Nelson, and a few nights ago was in Hempstead, New York. Now, why in the world would the governor of Louisiana be in Hempstead, New York?
I have no earthly idea. I wrote this past week that he's more difficult to find than Sasquatch.
Well, the governor was in Hempstead, New York, because it is the home of Hofstra University, and Hofstra University was the host of debate number 2 between President Obama and Governor Mitt Romney. And Governor Jindal, who quite often is featured on Fox News, was there front and center after the debate, and here was his observation.
I almost feel bad for the president. He has to defend his record. Here's a president who promised he'd turn the economy around in 3 years, hasn't done it, 23 million underemployed, unemployed Americans, promised he would cut the deficit in half, hasn't done it, $1 trillion in new debt every year, promised he would cut health care premiums by $2,500, hasn't done it, they've gone up. So, broken promise after broken promise, he can't run on his record.
All right, now Bobby Jindal has a state with the highest AIDS rate in America, a state with the highest murder rate in America, a state with the second highest poverty rate in America. Why isn't our governor talking about those issues?
Very good question. He should be defending his own record, not worrying about Obama defending his, because he has an abysmal record in addressing these issues. Health care is another issue that should be addressed by the governor, and the only way he's addressing it, he's laying people off. He just sent out a notice sent out this week laying off 41 people at EA Conway in Monroe.
Well, he really has, some would say, no choice, Tom, because the money is not there other than raising taxes, which he does not want to do.
Had he accepted some of these federal grants, he wouldn't have had to scrounge money to pay for the broadband internet that he's trying to pay for now and for early childhood development. That's $140 million in grants that he turned down that could have been used somewhere else.
297-5633, Tom Aswell, who has become known, like it or not, as a Jindal adversary, and he's a man who says he voted for the governor on 2 occasions. Now, as far as the governor traveling, we've talked about it at length on this show. He's not alone as far as being a traveling governor. I'm reading a story that was in the New York Times on Sunday. It says, during Governor Mitt Romney's 4-year term as governor of Massachusetts, he spent more than a year, 417 days out of state. More than 70% of that time was spent on personal or political trips unrelated to his job. So I would think that Bill Clinton, when he was ramping up to run for president in 1992 and he was governor of Arkansas, he certainly was out of state a lot when he was running in 1992. So why are we making a big deal about Bobby Jindal?
Well, I think Bobby Jindal's running for governor too, but
running for president.
I mean for president, but unlike Clinton and Romney, I think he's tilting at windmills.
Why?
I don't think he has a chance.
Why does he not have the same qualities that Bill Clinton and Mitt Romney have?
On the national stage, I think he's a lightweight, and I think the national media will eat him alive.
Well, he probably is weighs less than either Romney or Clinton. But
a political lightweight.
Now, why would you say that? He's a brilliant man, isn't he?
Brilliant man, so what? There are a lot of brilliant people that are not qualified to be the leader of the free world.
Well, there are very few people who have that opportunity.
That's correct.
As we know. And nonetheless, some people far less intelligent than Governor Jindal have probably been president of the United States.
I think we just had one, just left office.
And his name?
That would be George W. Bush.
He did score a 1280 on his SAT.
Yeah, well, okay.
I suspect Governor Jindal did very well as
I'm as sure
well.
He did.
But there's something beyond being book smart, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is. You have to be a diplomat. You have to be tactful, and you have to be able to address issues. And I just don't think Governor Jindal is doing that.
Well, he's got 3 years left. Monday at the Baton Rouge Press Club, Elliot Stonecipher, the well-versed demographer and pollster, said that Governor Jindal, if Mitt Romney is elected, will certainly join the Romney cabinet. Do you see that as a possibility or probability?
Of course, as soon as Romney secured the nomination, not when he was nominated, but as soon as he secured it, I remember Jindal coming out and saying he would not accept a cabinet position. And I thought it was kind of funny. He was declining an offer that had not been made yet. But I think in reality, I think certainly he would accept the cabinet position.
Now, why would he do that?
I don't know.
Unless he's Secretary of State.
I think it was a little premature for him to decline an offer that hadn't been made.
If he wants to be President of the United States, it would seem he would be better positioned as Governor of Louisiana than he would be, say, Secretary of Agriculture.
But if Romney is elected, you're looking at 8 years in office, possibly, and he has to keep his name.
You're already giving him two terms, Tom?
I said possibly. And Jindal's going to have to keep, if he wants to be president, he's going to have to keep his name out there before the public. So he's going to have to take something. He's either going to have to run against Mary Landrieu, or he's going to have to accept a cabinet position.
Or he could run for the Senate in 2016, the year that David Bruce Vitter is up for re-election.
And that's the day, I mean, and Vitter is being considered a viable candidate for governor of Louisiana. So, yeah, they could just switch positions, I suppose.
Yeah. What do you think about Vitter being our governor?
I like Jindal better.
Why?
I don't know. I have a problem with someone who goes around preaching family values and then does what Bitter did. I'm not a moralist, but I don't like hypocrisy.
Well, maybe he's in favor of family values for other people.
Perhaps.
And maybe he, as he said, he sinned.
Yeah, he certainly did, yeah.
Here's Bill Cassidy, congressman, who was dining at Louis's this morning in the early morning hours, saying, I absolutely would consider it. I'm an American as far as his run for the Senate, and he reiterated those words today over his egg whites at Louis's. Is he running against Mary Landrieu?
Sounds like it, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't
I saw
it?
The same story. It certainly sounds like he's running. And I have no problem with Cassidy.
Well, he would be a formidable candidate.
Yes,
I think.
He would.
But he's got the Jindal advisors on his team. Timmy Teeple is advising him.
So far, he's not paid Timmy Teeple a dime. I've checked his campaign finance records, and he hasn't paid him a dime yet. So I don't know what Timmy Teeple's doing for him. I do know that he's signed on with him, but he's not been paid anything yet.
Well, Timmy Teeple would be a good political operative, I would think, especially for a Republican candidate.
Perhaps. I'm not a big fan of Timmy Teeple. Perhaps he would. I may be letting my personal feelings take over here.
Well, that's what this show is all about, to let people say what's on their mind. And Tom Aswell will be back with us for a bit more time. Louisiana Voice is his blog. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org works as well. Back in 1 minute on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing. Our number locally, 297-5633. Tom Aswell of Louisiana Voice is with us for a bit longer. And he is a man who is unafraid to go places where some journalists will not go. And you're ruffling some feathers. I understand you were down at the Capitol yesterday.
Yes.
What was going on?
Well, today was supposed to be the day for the joint meeting of the House Appropriations and Senate Finance Committee to consider approving the contract with Blue Cross for the takeover of the group benefits, Office of Group Benefits. And intense lobbying was going on all day yesterday from both sides, proponents and opponents. Katrina Jackson was calling, trying to get people, the members of the committees to oppose the contract, and the governor's office was calling to try to get them to approve it. And at the late yesterday afternoon, Katrina Jackson called me and told me that the meeting had been canceled, and I can only read into that that the governor did not have the votes necessary to get the contract approved and canceled it. And in fact, there were two different stories that came out of there. House Appropriations Committee Chairman Jim Fannin said that they had not read the contract. They had only recently received it, and they wanted the chance to read it because it was 80 pages. The governor's office said key members were out of town. They needed to get their story straight.
297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Here's a question from John Williams. He says, would Tom Aswell comment on Governor Jindal's helicopter trips around the state? John continues, I'll read some of his additional remarks. I know he went extensively on Sunday mornings the year prior to the election, as the state police helicopter could be heard many, many Sunday mornings from my house in Spanish Town as he passed overhead. He justified the trips as visiting with locally elected officials.
I notice he has not visited a single church since he got reelected, not one.
Well, he goes to St. Aloysius.
Well, that's not a visit. He's a member there. I'm talking about these little Protestant churches in North Louisiana where he was flying around giving testimony leading up to his reelection. But since his reelection, he's not visited one.
Well, in this case, Tom, can't you give the governor a break? He is a politician. That's what politicians do, is in an election year, they travel to places they would not otherwise go.
Well, he's doing it under the pretense of giving testimony to his Christianity, and he's doing it to church members. And I thought that in this country we had separation of state and church.
Okay.
And he's politicking in churches.
A question from Johanna. She wants to know about the deal with Mercedes-Benz. We, the taxpayers, have yet to be told about how much money Mercedes-Benz paid to get the Superdome naming rights. When will we find out? Will Tom Aswell be able to unearth this?
Bob Mann and I are collaborating on an investigation of the perks and the incentives given the Benson family to keep the Saints in Louisiana, and that's an extensive investigation. We have several thousands of pages of documents that we're reviewing right now. So, yes, we will be looking into that. We are looking into it.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Tom Benson, now 85 years old, just bought a new toy, the New Orleans Hornets.
Yeah, and I'm sure he got some incentives for that, too.
Yeah, but on the other hand, isn't it better that the Hornets and the Saints stayed in Louisiana and there weren't a lot of takers?
Well, certainly, but you don't give up the store. You don't. At some point, you reach diminishing returns, and I think we've given them way too much in the way of incentives. For example, when a team from out of state plays in New Orleans, Atlanta, Carolina, they have to pay every team member on that team, the coaches, everyone who travels with the team, has to pay state income taxes on 1/16 of their income because they earn 1/16 of their salary in Louisiana, which is fair. But the moment the Department of Revenue gets that check, they turn right around and cut a check to the Bensons for that identical amount.
So the state gets nothing on it.
That's correct.
Hmm. But Benson could go to Los Angeles, second largest market in America. They have no professional football team. He could make a lot more money in Los Angeles than he could in New Orleans, despite all these benefits.
Correct. I think before he went to Los Angeles, he'd probably go to San Antonio.
Well, that's his hometown, right. Where his adopted hometown. But But nonetheless, from a business perspective, and believe me, Tom Benson is all about business.
Yes.
Los Angeles would make a lot of sense to a guy who loves money as much as Tom Benson does.
But would California give him those same incentives?
That's, well, but that, they might not have to, because he's suddenly in the second largest market as opposed to the 45th largest market.
Well, for some reason or other, the Rams moved out. So, you know, I don't know.
Well, that was because St. Louis gave them a lot of incentives to move
exactly
to the Midwest, and you make a point that if the Rams moved to St. Louis, why should the Saints move to Los Angeles? But it is remarkable that the NFL, in all its glory, doesn't have a team in Los Angeles, California.
Second largest market in America, yeah.
A bit more time with the outspoken Tom Aswell, who is a student of music, and Louisiana music is something that unites us. Maybe you and the governor could go to a concert together.
Don't start.
That's something that our governor, who vocalized transparency, there's very little we know about him. I have no idea what kind of music he likes, for example.
And, neither do I.
But I do know from his bodyguards that he is a religious watcher of Two and a Half Men. He loves that show.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I wasn't aware of that.
David in Lafayette. David, good morning. You're on with Tom Aswell.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Real quick, I have to agree with your guest, Jim, and the fact that if Los Angeles was such a great market, there would be a professional team there already.
Maybe there is. It's called the University of Southern California.
Can your guest repeat what he said in reference to the tax, the out-of-town professional teams coming to Louisiana? What was the tax rate again?
They pay 1/16 of their they pay state income taxes on 1/16 of their salary, because they have 16 games they play, and one of those is played in Louisiana. So they earn 1/16 of their income in Louisiana. So they have to pay state income tax on that. And I'm sure every state except Texas probably does that. Texas has no state income tax, so they don't do it. Mm-hmm. But I would imagine every state does that. And that's fair. I understand that. But when the Department of Revenue receives that check, it turns right around and cuts an identical check for that amount to the Benson family.
And to think about this, let's give Drew Brees is the classic example. He's making, what, $20 million
a year? Yeah.
Okay, so 1/16 of his salary is over $1 million.
Well, he pays one-half of taxes on one-half of his salary, because he plays half his games in Louisiana. I'm talking about visiting teams.
No, but if somebody were compensated at the same level, and there are a few players in the league who
are. Like Peyton Manning, for example.
Yeah, then 1/16 of that goes to the state.
That's correct.
And then the state, you're saying, gives it back to...
we're talking about millions of dollars.
Tom Benson.
Millions of dollars.
And the state is also paying a handsome rate for office space in Benson Tower.
That's correct.
Across the street from the Superdome.
That's correct. A lot of state offices were forced to move in there at premium rates, much higher than they were already paying.
Well, Tom Benson arguably is the most powerful person in the state of Louisiana.
That would be a valid argument.
So why would the governor want to pick a fight with Tom Benson?
I don't think it's a point of issue of picking a fight. I think it's just at some point you have to say no.
At some point, and you're saying that should have happened a long time ago.
I think we're way past.
Well, there have been other governors preceding Bobby Jindal who didn't say no to Tom Benson.
Many of these incentives that were given to Saints were done so during the Blanco administration, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, Blanco, and the guy.
And Foster.
Foster, right. And of course, Edwin Edwards is the fellow who found Tom Benson in 1985.
That's correct. So you can't lay all of the blame at Jindal's feet.
Steve in Gramercy asks how Tom Aswell thinks Governor Jindal would do on the big stage for a presidential debate with either – why are you laughing? – with either a Republican challenger or the Democratic nominee.
Well, in terms of words per minute, I think he would win hands down. But I don't know that those words would carry any substance, because he simply gets up and recites a laundry list when he's talking. He doesn't really give any substantial information when he is talking.
There was some genuine emotion the other night with Governor Romney and President Obama.
Some sparks. Yeah.
Some sparks.
Yeah.
I thought at one point one might challenge the other to a wrist wrestling competition,
Or maybe a $10,000 bet.
yeah, that's. That's what Romney did, right? Walking around money when you've got $250 million.
Correct.
But Mitt Romney is he's the quintessential product of the American dream, isn't he?
Well, I suppose so. He's got a lot of money, but then so does Nancy Pelosi. And
so does Barack Obama.
And Bob Kerry, yeah.
A lot of that...
John Kerry, I'm sorry.
John did it the old-fashioned way. He married it,
yes,
right?
He did.
Yeah. He married Teresa Hines after he dated Morgan Fairchild.
Yep.
And if he'd married Morgan Fairchild, he might have been president. Because exit polls showed the electorate didn't like Teresa very much.
Is that right?
I think they probably liked Morgan better.
Well, there you go.
Okay. Well, Tom Aswell, always fun to talk with you, and I'm sure you'll be out there doing what you do. And this man is an intrepid reporter, and you've been doing this a long time.
Yes, I have.
Okay. Well, keep doing it, and we'll keep talking. Thank you, Tom Aswell. 297-5633 is your number. We switch gears, and we're joined in studio by Lauren Stewart. She is Executive Director and Program Coordinator of the Greater Baton Rouge Clean Cities Coalition. Good morning, Lauren. How are you? All right, Kevin. Lauren Stewart is here to talk about Louisiana Alternative Fuel Vehicle Odyssey Day. That's today.
It's this afternoon, beginning at 12:30 and running through 6:30 in the evening.
So what happens today at the Capitol Park Welcome Center?
Well, this is an event that is taking place across the country today. The Odyssey Day features alternative fuel vehicle technologies and the markets and policies that support them. And so our event will have a symposium with in-depth discussions about Louisiana-specific policy mm-hmm. landscape and highlighting successful projects. And then come evening, we'll move outside for an expo of car and trucks that run on compressed natural gas, propane, electricity. And we'll also have musical performances by John Gray and a jazz trio and some dueling fiddles as well.
And this is right downtown, isn't it?
That is correct.
Okay, 702 North River Road, and it'll be quite an event, the Louisiana Alternative Fuel Vehicle Odyssey Day. And this is something you have been a proponent of. Why do you think we are so reluctant to switch to this kind of transportation?
Well, I think it's a challenge of incorporating new technology into the marketplace. And there is some apprehension due to past experiences. For example, with compressed natural gas, decades ago, we installed a CNG station here in Baton mm-hmm. Rouge and started incorporating those vehicles into our local fleets. But they had to be converted, and the kits that changed a vehicle from conventional fuel to CNG affected the efficiency and performance. But these days, these cars are coming directly from the manufacturer, and they perform as well as their comparable conventional counterparts.
297-5633 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'll spend a bit more time with Lauren Stewart, the Executive Director and Program Coordinator of the Greater Baton Rouge Clean Cities Coalition. And this is a passion that you have had for a while, going back to your days at LSU, correct?
That's right.
So why did you become so immersed in this topic?
Well, I began working with transportation at the Planning Commission and realizing how much transportation affects our daily lives. I mean, when it comes to traffic congestion or air quality or simply mobility and getting from A to B, these things really affect all of us. And I think that having choices in our fuels allows for people an out of high gas prices, and the same way that having bike paths allows for people a recreational, healthy mode of transportation.
Mm-hmm. I noticed some of the sponsors of today's event are car makers.
Mm-hmm.
So how are they involved in making this transition?
Well, like I mentioned, the manufacturers are beginning to produce these alternative fuel vehicles straight off the line. So, for example, Nissan has an electric vehicle. Some of them, such as Ford, for example, are still playing the role of upfitters, that is, taking the conventionally fueled vehicle and converting it into an alternative fuel. And so we have both on display.
All right, 297-5633 for Lauren Stewart, who is an active environmental type, the executive director and program coordinator of the Greater Baton Rouge Clean Cities Coalition. Barry in Mid-City, good morning, Barry. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you, Jim. I wanted to mention to your guest that several years ago, my brother took me on a trip through Poland. Our VW bus vehicle used compressed gas like you're talking about. How come Poland was doing it several years ago and it was pretty commonplace?
Well, Barry raises a good point that these alternative fuels are not so radical, and really they are very commonly used in many parts of the country. In Latin America, there is also a large supply of natural gas, and they have figured out that it is more affordable option for them to fuel their vehicles. And in Europe, Poland is new to me, but I knew that in Ireland they're using advanced synthetic biofuels. And so really these technologies vary, and they are quite established, and so it's just a matter of a domestic vehicle market producing the vehicles and for the infrastructure to be in place to fuel them.
Well, some of the speakers, thank you, Barry, who'll be featured today include Dr. Mike Strain, the Agriculture Secretary for Louisiana. What will Dr. Strain be focusing upon?
Dr. Strain actually has a great announcement about his fleet beginning to incorporate compressed natural vehicles, and that is because of the economic value to our state. So he will be showing up in his brand new CNG truck and hopefully make an announcement about more vehicles to come in the Department of Agriculture and Forestry fleet.
And there will be an Alternative Fuel Success Stories panel. Who's on the panel?
The moderator is Gifford Briggs, who is the vice president of LOGA. And the panel will feature the president and CEO of the Lafayette Chamber, as well as their city government transportation director and a representative of their fuel supplier, which is Apache.
That's Gifford Briggs from the Louisiana Oil and Gas Association. Now, the expo lineup includes over a dozen electric cars, right? Biofueled cars, you've got, and trucks. You've got some vehicles that people, I'm sure, would be extremely curious about.
Yeah, one in particular is interesting. It's renewable natural gas. It is a biomethane project that the St. Landry's Parish Solid Waste completed a couple of years ago, and they're now fueling their trucks with methane that is captured from their landfill, which is very innovative.
And a great lineup of music all during the day, located at the AZ Young Lawn and Pentagon Barracks behind the Welcome Center, so right downtown. You mentioned John Gray, so it should be quite an event, and some fascinating vehicles and interesting people, including Lauren Stewart, who also will talk, right?
That's right.
It all starts at 1:30?
Yes.
1:30 this afternoon. Thank you, Lauren, and appreciate the comments about the Odyssey Day near the Capitol. 297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757. We will return after this brief timeout on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757, and inkstershow@wrkf.org online. Our guest at this time is Herbie Pilato. His biographical target is one that any of us who grew up in the 60s and 70s will remember well. Elizabeth Montgomery, who died in 1995 at 62 of colon cancer, and she remains one of the enduring stars of television, based, of course, on reruns of Bewitched. Good morning, Herbie Pilato.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, Herbie, Elizabeth Montgomery hasn't been on network television in 40 years. 40 years, but yet people, they know the music and they know Samantha. How do you explain the enduring popularity of this show and this star?
Well, now, just listening to that music, doesn't it make you smile?
Yeah, it does.
I mean, it automatically puts a smile on your face. And you know, in the 1960s, and really in any era where there's just a lot of, issues or social issues that people want to escape from, they usually run to entertainment. And some of the worst eras brings about some of the happiest entertainment, which is what Bewitched was. There was a down-to-earth charm about Elizabeth that somehow she connected with the mainstream, and we just all fell in love with her, and she embraced her celebrity for, you know, the betterment of humanity. I know that sounds a little heavy duty, but really that's what she did. And her character of Samantha, you know, gave up the magic life to be a regular person. And I think a lot of people really just were attracted to that because they probably looked at their marriages and said, well, you know, if Samantha can make her marriage work so very different, then maybe mine can too.
Well, there were two different Darrens through the years of Bewitched, Dick York and Dick Sargent. That usually is a kind of transition that is difficult for a series to withstand.
Correct. And you know what? They do it all the time on soap operas, you know, and the really neat thing approach that they took with Bewitched is Dick York, who was the first Darren, he had missed 14 episodes of the show because he was still recovering from a pain injury that he received on the set of They Came from Cordura, which was a movie he had done from before Bewitched, that, and he was on a railroad car during this scene, and he threw out his back, and he never recovered from that. So he ended up missing a lot of the episodes of The Witch, which were called non-Darren episodes. Well, when they finally realized that they could no longer keep missing, you know, that he could no longer keep missing the show. I mean, the show was about Samantha and Darren. It wasn't really just about Samantha. The conflict that he brought to that show is what made the show. So they finally said, well, we got to replace him. So they didn't want to because they loved Dick York. He was brilliant, but they had no choice. So that summer, before Dick Sargent took over in the fall of 69, that summer ABC reran all the episodes of Bewitched without Darren, without his presence, so that when the new one was introduced and without any fanfare, it was just like a seamless entry. Did people notice? Of course they did. Was the show never the same? No, it wasn't. Did it drop in the ratings? Yes. But if you're going to have a second Darren, you know, certainly Dick Sargent was a perfect choice for that.
877-217-5757 for Herbie Pilato. His book is Twitch Upon a Star, The Bewitched Life and Career of Elizabeth Montgomery. Despite the fun times that were had on Bewitched, she had her share of challenges in her life. I'm sure at times were present on the set. How did she overcome the challenges that she had?
Well, she was married four times. You know, when you're a celebrity, you're not a regular person. You know, and she was a super celebrity. Bewitched put ABC on the map. She was a big star in the '60s. So there's a lot of pressure that goes along with that, and you're constantly meeting new people, constantly feeling stressed out, trying to relieve that stress. On the set of Bewitched, you had Agnes Moorehead, you know, who played her mom so brilliantly. Very feisty character, very feisty actress. Agnes Moorehead was not happy at all when Dick York left the series and was replaced by Dick Sargent. And Elizabeth was not happy with the fact that Agnes Moorehead made it difficult for Dick Sargent. And she finally had a talk with her about that. Elizabeth's personal life, she was married four times to Fred Kamen,
Roller, New York, a prestigious man who was her first marriage when she was only 21 years old, gig young, alcoholic, actor, troubled, controlling person who killed his wife, second wife later in a double murder-suicide after he killed him, before he killed himself. And then Bill Asher, wonderful, brilliant director from I Love Lucy, the Patty Duke show. He did the Beach Party movies. But when the show Bewitched started waning, so did their marriage, you know, which happens many times. And then Robert Foxworth, who she met on the set of Mrs. Sundance, was he, along with Bill Asher, were the equal loves of her life. However, they were together 20 years, and they were only married in the last year and a half of that relationship. So I think that had she had met Fred Kamen later in life, that would have been her one and only marriage, because he was a great man and a great soul and you know, a sweet guy. But they were just too young, and he didn't want her to act, and she wanted a career at the time. So it was just wrong. There'd be no Bewitched if they ever got married and stayed, or if they had stayed married. But she would have, I think, had a very different and happy life. Not as though her life wasn't happy with Bewitched, but it would have been a different kind of happy.
Herbie Pilato, the biographer of Elizabeth Montgomery. She was only 62 when she died. You note that she married Robert Foxworth only a little over a year before she died. It was not a pretty ending for a pretty lady, was it?
No, I mean, you know, cancer is just a horrible, horrible thing. I lost my dad to it. I've lost many friends to it. And the thing about Elizabeth, and Robert Foxworth has said this, that she didn't want to get old, you know. And when you live such a full, incredible life of a celebrity like she did, when you give so much of yourself, you know, and you're always you're at this high energy for such a, over six decades, she didn't want to get old. And it was time for her to go. And whether she made that decision on a spiritual level, which I believe we all do, or not, you know, she once said, when you're done, you're done. You just move on, just like with Bewitched. When she was done with Bewitched, she never looked back. And it was very difficult for her in the end, but then she came to an acceptance of it. But my gosh, you know, dying at 62, any way you look at it, is a tragic thing.
Now, she was, what, a 9-time Emmy nominee? Is that correct?
Yeah, it was seven or eight times. She had been nominated before Bewitched for The Untouchables, where she played a prostitute. And then she was nominated 5 or 6 times for Bewitched, and then for A Case of Rape in 1974, and The Legend of Lucy Borden in 1975. And she had done like 200 TV guest star roles before Bewitched, which were very, very different, and many were similar to her, you know, violent, victimized movies later on. But I missed, and I think a lot of people missed, the spark of comedic genius that she brought to Bewitched, and I wish she would have done more comedies, and I told her that.
She never won an Emmy, though, did she?
No, she never won, and you know, it's in those days the Emmys and the Oscars or whatnot were really more of a popularity contest, and I think the Academy looked at her and said, "Well, she's beautiful. She's the daughter of Robert Montgomery. She's rich. She's got a hit TV show. We're not going to give her an Emmy, too." You know, but she never said that it bothered her. But you know, how could it not? You know, her husband won for Best Director, and Alice Pierce won, who played Mrs. Kravitz, for Best Supporting Actress posthumously. But Elizabeth never won. And, you know, even though she was modestly saying it never bothered her, I kind of think it did.
Uh-huh. How did you know Elizabeth?
I met Elizabeth because I was going to work on a new Bewitched series with Bill Asher. I had written a reunion for the original show. She didn't want to do that, and then Bill was going to do this new show. When the financing fell through for that new show, I said, "Well, Bill, how about I do a book about the original series? You think Elizabeth would be open to that?" And he said, "Yeah." So he really talked to her, paved the way for me. And then after I wrote the Bewitched book and Bewitched Forever, I realized there was still so much information about her life before and after Bewitched that needed to be addressed, and I wanted to be the one to do it. So 20 years later, almost to the day, Twitch Upon a Star is published after the Bewitched book.
Well, she was busy after Bewitched, too. The series ran from 1964 to 1972, starting with I, Darren, Take This Witch, and concluding, what, in season 8 with The Truth, Nothing But The Truth, So Help Me Sam. After Bewitched, what were some of her most notable appearances?
Yeah, like I said, The Case of Rape, The Legend of Lizzie Borden. She narrated the documentaries about the Iran-Contra affair, which was like, what's going on here? Cover Up was the first film in 1988, and then its sequel, 1991's The Panama Deception, which won an Oscar. But she also did, like, animated voiceovers for shows like Batman, and that was the last thing that she did. And there were the last two TV movies she did were based on Edna Buchanan, the Miami, Florida crime reporter, and it was supposed to be a regular series of movies. And then, of course, she died, and she was sick during filming of the last film, and it was just so sad, just very, very sad.
Herbie, a listener asked about a movie that Elizabeth made with O.J. Simpson, and I think I found it. You have a list of all her productions, and was it A Killing Affair?
Yeah, crazy title for that movie, right?
Yeah.
From what I understand, O.J. kind of had a thing for Elizabeth. I mean, who wouldn't, right? She's beautiful and sweet and down to earth. But she didn't want to have anything to do with him, and she had just been with Robert Foxworth. She was totally in love with Robert Foxworth, and I would have to say that he and Bill Asher were the equal loves of her life. That movie today is almost unwatchable, not because of the content, because it was really groundbreaking to have a Caucasian woman and an African American man really kissing on screen and being in bed together. It was quite amazing. It's not unwatchable because of that by no means, but it's unwatchable because of the co-star, which is, it's just hard to watch. But I have to say, A Case of Rape and The Legend of Lizzie Borden, for me personally as a kid, were hard to watch. I couldn't watch Samantha get raped. I couldn't watch Samantha axe murder her parents, and I told Elizabeth that too.
Well,
what
you bring up as far as her being typecast, that's something that Max Baer, who played Jethro on the Beverly Hillbillies, said. It made him impossible to work in the industry, because every time he would come on the screen as a priest or as a whatever, people would say, "Hey, there's Jethro." And she was synonymous with being Samantha Stevens.
Yes, but it did not stop her. She did not experience the Jethro experience, though. She still, because of her talent, because of really her metaphoric or metamorphic way of changing her appearance and just her, her core talent. Her talent carried her through. Samantha was who she was. You watch Samantha, that was who Elizabeth was, that down-to-earth person. The characters before and after, there are aspects of herself that she brought to those characters. There was the anger that she had towards her dad, who divorced her mother. Her father was Robert Montgomery, the great actor. Her mother, Elizabeth Allen, that she brought that kind of anger to the legend Lizzie Borden. The anger that she had towards Gig Young, the victimization of being abused by that alcoholic, controlling man, she used to help interpret her character in her first TV movie after Bewitched, called The Victim. Any good actor, takes from pieces of their life and applies it to their character. But for a role like Samantha, which comes along once in a lifetime for anyone, and any actor would love to be in a series for 8 years, that was Elizabeth. That mm-hmm. charming, sweet, down-to-earth girl was Elizabeth.
Now, my first exposure to Paul Lynde was on Bewitched. He was a part of that ensemble that was quite impressive.
And the great thing is, Jim, that he only did 8 episodes of the show. and only seven is Uncle Arthur. He first appeared as like a mortal driving instructor in the first year. But his persona and his talent, talk about talent, was just so outstanding and so memorable that everybody thinks he was like he appeared every week and he didn't. And she loved him. Bill Asher loved him. Elizabeth loved him. And then later, after Bewitched ended, she and Bill Asher produced his Paul Lynde show for Ashmont Productions, and he also starred in the New Temperatures Rising show, replacing James Whitmore, who was in the original Temperatures Rising, and both of those shows were produced by Bill and Elizabeth.
Now, is it true, I think I know the answer, and in fact you reflect on it, is it true that she had a friendship with President John F. Kennedy?
Yes, she did. Her husband, actually, Bill Asher, directed the famous birthday bash at which Marilyn Monroe sang a breathy happy birthday. And then, as fate would have it, on the day that Bewitched began rehearsals, is November 22nd, 1963, the day that President Kennedy died, which was just a bizarre thing for everyone. And certainly, a few years later, Robert Kennedy was assassinated, and Martin Luther King was assassinated, and Bewitched, helped us through that all with its magic, along with the Munsters and, the Addams Family. But Bewitched stood out because the core message was prejudice, that we have to learn to love each other despite our differences, and we have to concentrate on what makes us the same, which is our humanity. And many minorities and many people who felt different or whatever were attracted to Bewitched. And to this day, the show is written so well that the only thing dated about it really are the clothes, and even those are coming back.
Well, thank
you. Oh, there you go.
Thank you, Herbie Pilato. Twitch Upon a Star, The Bewitched Life and Career of Elizabeth Montgomery. That's the book. Herbie is the founder and executive director of the Classic TV Preservation Society. It's a nonprofit organization that seeks to close the gap between popular culture and education. Thanks so much, Herbie Pilato.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening, everybody. We will return tomorrow, same time, same place. Kevin Gallagher producing, and hope you have a great day, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.